This is episode 454 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Mike Austin and Greg Migliori. We talk about the Land Rover Range Rover Evoque convertible, the Cadillac XT5, and Volkswagen's Goodwill package for diesel owners. That's all ahead on episode 454 of the Autoblog Podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Greg Migliori.
Hey, Dan.
And Mike Austin.
Hello out there in podcast world.
So we'll hit the garage. And Greg, you drove a couple of things. One of my favorite car brands is Scion. you actually got to drive the TC. And it's been sort of like this vehicle that's been around for a long time. They keep quietly like tweaking it and updating it. What did you think?
Yeah, so I'm spending a couple days in it. I'm kind of taking one for the team. A couple people needed to swap out cars and they were sick and stuff. So I'm rolling around town in this thing and, you know, it's they did some light updates to it. I kind of like the styling. It's a little more lines and stuff, I guess, on the side. It's got a manual. That's cool.
Oh, with a manual, it's surprisingly unterrible.
It is now, what, 10 years old, though? How does it feel?
It feels a little aged. You know, they've done some things to make the interior a little bit better, but I mean, it's a pretty basic car. And I always come back to the fact that like you're driving this because it's like, hey, you want something a little different, a little sporty, pay a little bit more and like get a Mustang or something, or, you know, just keep it simple and get like a Civic Coupe. I think the new Civic Coupe looks way cooler than this thing.
Yeah, the thing with the TC, though, is like it's halfway, like it's essentially a Corolla. I think it's based on the Avensis, which is a Toyota we don't get, but like it's halfway practical. It's like one of those like perfect Scions, right? It's the first car. It's a little bit sporty looking. It drives perfectly fine, completely unobtrusive, and it does what it does without much of, you know, any issue. Where like a Mustang is a little bit more of a handful. It's a lot less practical. So like in terms of where they want to be, I got out of this the last time I drove a TC. I was like, you know, I grudgingly accept that this car has a place in the market and that it does what it does well.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I think I grudgingly accept that it has a spot in the market too. And I mean,
at
frankly,
the bottom of the market.
Yeah, I mean, the spot, the actual positioning, maybe, you know, is questionable. But I am glad, I will say this, that people are still making coupes, you know? I mean, coupes, I think, are kind of intrinsically fun when done correctly. And, yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying this just because I haven't driven a manual transmission two-door in at least a few weeks, which, you know, this job is kind of uncommon. And it's fun to drive around. I don't think this is a car I would recommend to purchase, but... you know, and I was just looking at the sticker. It actually starts at 21,330. A little more than I thought it would be, actually. That's with the automatic. But still, I don't know. This feels kind of, to me, more like an $18,000 car.
Yeah, especially the interior. Like the quality of the plastics and stuff like that. But
yeah, and it doesn't have satellite radio, which for me is a cardinal sin. I need to listen to my college sports stations. Wait. And, you know, It's rough, man.
It's got that head unit that looks like all of the billboards in Times Square all at once, and it doesn't have satellite radio.
Pretty much. This one doesn't.
Sucks. Well, so you jumped from that, though, to the Buick Regal GS. So was that must have had satellite radio for you to, like, get your... Which university, which college sports, you know, are you a fan of?
Oh, yeah. That's satellite channel 84. All college sports all the time. It's... you know, get all your Big Ten stuff on it.
Excellent.
But anyways, the Regal GS did have that. It's a pretty cool car, I think. It's got the, like, the blinged out, like, I don't even know how to describe them, like, octopus wheels. They're like, you know, it's cool. I think they look good. Some people are going to be like, that's a bit much, but why not, you know?
I like the design. There's a little too much chrome for me.
A little too much chrome. It's not enough chrome for me, but that's just me.
It's a Buick, though. I mean, it's supposed to be chromey, and I was shocked by the way the Regal drives overall. Like, honestly, that's like a sleeper. That car is, every time I get in one, I'm just like very impressed by the ride and handling trade-off, the way, especially the all-wheel drive ones, they'll actually hang their tail out a little bit if you shut off the traction controls. They can be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's a really, I think it's a really good chassis. That's like an Opel chassis, basically by engineering roots. And yeah, it's fun to drive. I think steering feels pretty good. It's actually almost to the point where you're like, whoa, this is a Buick. I sound like a Buick commercial, but it sounds, you're like, you know, you'd be on the road. You're like, wow, this thing's, you know, sportier than you would expect.
Yeah, I drove it too, and I came in with the same kind of feeling from the driving. I was like, this is really good. The steering, it's a heavy steering, but it's weighty. Again, ride handling is fantastic. It's got like a really good composed suspension, but it's not too crashy. I got out of the Regal and into an Acura TLX, which is essentially two versions of the same car, and the difference is kind of interesting. The TLX, I didn't sit in the back seat of either, but the TLX seems bigger on the inside. It's a little more airier cabin, not roomier. But the TLX has like Eagle LS2 tires on it, and the Regal has some sort of summer hotness. And you can really tell, even just the tire, but I think the overall chassis tuning, the Regal is made to feel sportier. For me, the thing that killed the Regal is the interior. You've got like a bunch of cheap plastic and then like five different surfaces. They still have chrome and nickel in the same interior, and then like weird black plastic. And you're like, was this designed by committee and then like hacked to pieces by the accountants?
Probably. That sounds like GM.
If you can get over that, it's great to drive. Yeah, it's like the ghosts of old GM.
But I was going to say, you get in that car and it feels like 2011 or something. It's a little bit of a time transport.
But I think we're especially attuned to that, where like it does inside, it does, the cabin does most everything right. Like the seats are comfortable and supportive. The controls are well placed. They're pretty easy to use, except for those. It's got the slider things, right, for the temperature. Or something. It's got
this is the refreshed interior,
which I
think is 2 years old, and it has capacitive touch for the temperature.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
If you need to move, I don't know if it slides. I tried to slide it.
I meant like you slide your thumb over it or whatever.
Well, this was like it's a button, non-button. You just put your finger at the red triangle or the blue triangle, and it took me forever. Actually, this is a big point of, maybe we'll get into some deeper office debate. I got in it after Greg, who had it on manual setting, which to me, my view on climate control is it's a thermostat. You don't need a manual setting.
I always put it on manual.
Let Greg defend himself. But anyway.
No, I'm with you, Greg, man. Manual all the way. If I want it hot, I will set it to hot.
Okay, good. Now that I know it's 2-1, I can say that you're both idiots. But
it's not a house. It's a car.
It took me like 30 taps to get it from the 82 degree setting to like 72 and then hit auto.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
My default setting. I get in the car and I'm like, if it's above 60 degrees, I put it as cold as possible, like a freezer. And now that it's kind of chilly here, I just crank it. Like auto, it just doesn't get it as warm. I want to be like baked.
So what I don't like about auto.
So you put it on auto at 80.
I don't know. It'll blow cold air at you at some point. It'll just like start barfing cold air at you. And you're like, no,
yes.
I want heat all the time. I want hot air out of the vents. If I want it colder, right, I'll open a window. Which I realize is like completely inefficient. I get it. I'm a control freak. I don't like stuff thinking for me. Even if it does a better job, which I'm sure it does. So that brings me to what I'm driving this week, which was an Audi A5. And I had it a little bit last week and like for a day or two. And I confessed on the podcast that I kind of hate it for the Q3 because it.
Q3 or A5?
Q3. I'm sorry. Did I say A5? Because I would not mind an A5 in those old. The Q3 is like it's tiny. And the stuff that I didn't like about it last week, I still don't like about it. Like it was really difficult for me to find a comfortable driving position. The relationship between the pedals, the wheel, and sort of like a comfortable seat setup were weird. I don't know if it's just because it's squished on that platform or what. It felt strange. And then the wheel blocks some of the gauges and stuff. So I know that's very picky, but typically Audis do that like perfectly and they drive really well. The Q3, it drives okay. It rides and handles nicely, like you'd expect. But the steering, like, it doesn't have that Audi sense of straight ahead. And, like, just generally, I was driving it and I was like, why would you buy this over even a Tiguan? Especially for the money. Like, it's just, it's a lot of dough for something that's that's small, and it makes the Q5 look huge. I parked it next to a Q5 yesterday, and I was just like, wow, this is very small.
If you think the Q5, if you think the Q3 is pricey, though, like, look at Q5 prices. Like, used Q5s don't drop below 40 grand. I was shocked when I saw that.
Yeah, and, like, honestly, the Audi stuff that it does well. It's, like, excellent design inside and out. The materials are good. It's... You know, it's got good composure for the most part. I thought it had more road noise than it should, and the engine's kind of growly and feels a little weak. Part of that might be the transmission was kind of dumb. I guess I just didn't feel technical term, right? Yeah, I mean, it was just slow-witted. In sport mode, it was better, but it's still just like it felt flat-footed all around. I was just like, why would you spend this kind of money on this? Like, you're sacrificing here where you can get a Tiguan and it'll be pretty close to the same experience. You'll have more space, and like you're not paying for the maybe extra little bit of niceness, but overall it's probably a better value. And like, then there's the Audi backward control thing that still just bugs me. you go to like select stuff on the nav screen and that knob operates backward, and you're just like, why? And then they all don't operate backward. Some of them, like that single knob, you turn it to the left and stuff scrolls down or whatever. I forget exactly how it goes, but that drove me crazy. There's a lot of competition now. Like, you could get a Lincoln MKC, which is going to feel just as good on the road, I think, and have just as nice an interior and probably get a lot more for your dollar.
You might be the first person to say that on the podcast, to defend the MKC. I think it's
a brave statement.
I think it's unfairly slaughtered in journalist conversation.
What, the MKC?
So, yeah. So you have a good point there.
Yeah. For what most people buy it for, I think it's great. And it's based on the Escape, which is like a brick outhouse on the road. It feels fantastic. It's, you know.
I actually gave it a good review. I may have been the only guy in the industry who was like, I like the MKC.
Well, then we're in agreement. Although I don't think I put brick outhouse on my like desired feel.
That's another technical term for man, right?
I'm doing the writerly hyperbole thing, but it just like it feels so solid. That's the small Fords lately. They feel every bit as solid as the German vehicles they compete with, whether it's Volkswagen or, you know, with Lincoln against Audi. So that's really one of the things that was always lagging, was like they just didn't feel as good on the road. The Escape and the MKC do. So that removes a big stumbling block in my mind. And, you know, the Lincoln's going to have a lot more stuff for a lot less money, and you can beat the hell out of those dealers. Although I don't think you'll have a problem beating up an Audi dealer these days either. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now is a good time to walk into a Volkswagen Group dealership and play any card you want, see what you can do.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, well, let's get to topics, because we've seen a couple of things. I think everything we're going to talk about this week, we have, we're going to see more information about at LA. sort of the first thing that came across our desk was the Land Rover Range Rover Evoque convertible, which seems to be a weird play for them, just given the fact that we all laughed at the Nissan Murano Cross Cabriolet, and this is kind of like their version of the same thing. So I guess I'll pose it to you guys, like, why?
Wow, that's a pretty deep question, actually.
I love it.
Why do you love it?
I love the cross cab because, first of all, a convertible. There aren't enough convertibles. People don't. It's something like 2% of the market now. People don't buy convertibles enough. I don't know, like, if it's some post 9/11 mentality of, like, you know, you need to feel secure, or if it's just people think it's impractical and like they're not willing to accept the compromise for the like great feel. Think about the last time you've driven a convertible. You open up the top and you have a panoramic view behind you.
Yeah.
It makes your day better. It's so great.
Yeah.
So I'm pro convertible to begin with. And so then I guess if you extrapolate that to where the market is, we need a convertible SUV. The Murano was by no means a good driving car, and it looked silly, but that's the thing. You were just driving around in a weird clown car. I kind of loved it for that. So, okay. I mean, I don't think there's nothing specifically Range Rover-y about the Evoque that, or anything about its style that makes it special. It's just like, all right, here we go. This is the, you know, this is the Dodge Rampage or the Dakota Convertible Mark III.
Wow. Wow. You know what? I, not to be too agreeable here, but I like that. I like the Evoque convertible too. I think it's, they're not saying, hey, this is what, you know, Land Rover and Range Rover are going to be. They're saying, hey, we can do this. Some people are going to like it. We're going to roll with it. See what happens. I like the Evoque. I think it's a good looking vehicle. I think it drives pretty well. And hey, if they want to chop the top off, go for it.
I mean, well, funny thing is, I think Range Rover, I think that the Evoque itself has a little more cachet than the Murano. And
oh, definitely.
Especially globally.
Yeah.
Where it's more of a fashion thing. I think like it'll be looked at favorably from a styling perspective for like, I don't know, like the Cannes Mediterranean set.
Yeah, I definitely think it's
gonna... reasonably priced too, I think. I mean, for these things anyway. Go ahead, Dan.
No, it's definitely going to do better than the Murano, I think, and at least in people's opinion, just because it is a Land Rover, you know, and it has that brand recognition and respect. I mean, certainly it solves the visibility problem out of the Evoque. So there's that. It just like when you look at it, Jerry McGovern, Land Rover's guy who introduced it, basically, he was like, it's a natural extension of the design. It broadens the appeal. And I'm like, I mean, okay, sure.
He'll say anything. It's like,
yeah, it's
I have the idea, so it must have been great.
Right. I mean, and I think honestly, like, sure, it's another way for them to.
Their last Land Rover press car ever.
I think it's a good way for them to offer something to their buyers. Like, honestly, it's a fashion brand, and if they're gonna, if anybody can pull it off and make a market for it, you know, somebody like Land Rover can do that. I did find his comment that it's the first truly capable convertible in terms of terrain to be wrong. I mean, perhaps he's forgotten about his own company's actual Land Rovers, or you know, like the Jeep Wrangler, which they're not exactly the same thing, but they're certainly, you can put the top down on one of those and go off road. So, yeah, they're positioning it weird, but I think it'll do okay, even though it has like 9 cubic feet of luggage space, which is pretty useless.
I mean, it's, you know, again, it's like a fancy watch or something. You know, you can tell time with, you know, an egg timer if you want, but I mean, people buy all kinds of different things, and it's like, hey. This is fun. Why not? You know, also,
I'll argue that the Evoque is largely useless as a cargo proposition anyway. So
I will agree with that. Yeah.
I put a snowboard bag in one once and I had to go back and forth between the front, middle and hatch like 3 times to get, you know, to fold and then move a seat out of the way and then move it back and then move my cargo in. For an SUV, it was kind of sad.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Evoque other than its styling. Like, I didn't like driving it, which is weird because I love the Discovery Sport, which is the same basic vehicle, just sort of softened up. So it's my old guy tendency, I'm assuming. But I think
with the Evoque, too, it almost like, and this is almost like blasphemy to say, I don't know, it's like that would almost work as a Jaguar, you know, just slap the, you know, the big cat out there and it's... you know, it's a Jaguar because it's not like this, you know, crazy rough and tumble SUV. I mean, not really. So
no, I mean, they show it like going on a dirt road and in the snow.
Sure.
In the video, their launch video. So
right.
that's what they're trying to do. And okay, sure. I'd be interested to see if Jaguar does a F-Pace convertible. That, you know, might be some interesting sibling.
Yeah, record. That would be interesting.
So
as we invent future product here.
Yeah, why not? So yeah, we'll know more about that one after we, it's going to get its US introduction in LA. And so we've got people headed for it right now. stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing we saw that's going to be in LA is the Cadillac XT5, which is the replacement for the SRX. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I'm saying, thank God they finally restyled the SRX and made it the XT5. Cause this looks so much better, which, you know, the styling is shallow, but I really like the way it looks.
I like how it looks too, but I don't think they went far enough, to be honest. And I like Cadillacs usually, but when I look at this thing, at least in pictures, to me, it still kind of looks like the old SRX, like the silhouette of it. And just the general proportions. Dimensionally, it's about the same. They stretch the wheelbase, I think like about an inch or so. So, you know, it's definitely a different animal, but I think maybe they could have done something different in the back or just, you know, like you say, design is shallow, but I would have liked to have seen maybe a slightly different vibe to separate it. Otherwise, I think it'll do pretty well. I mean, they've got a new chassis. They've got the new GM engine family in it, some new transmissions. It's lighter. It's got more space. It kind of passes all the tests that Cadillac needs in that crossover segment, I think.
I think they're committing a cardinal sin, though. The best engine option seems like it's not going to be for us, the turbo four-cylinder. What's up with that?
I don't get that at all. It's going to launch in China, and you don't see that very much these days with CAFE and everything else going on that, hey, we're going to go with the V6 here and then save the turbo four for China. That's a little bit of a head scratcher. And, you know, if I get time with any Cadillac execs in LA, that's going to be the first thing I ask is, hey, what's going on here? Can you explain? What are you thinking?
Yeah. I mean, my only guess would be like target fixation on the RX, cause that doesn't have a four cylinder. But if you look at the rest of the segment, everyone has a four. I mean, in China, I think it's probably a displacement and tax play.
But sure.
Right.
Sure.
There's no reason why a car that size, you know, they do it in the non-luxury versions of that size already, and it works out well.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a bit of a head scratcher.
It also sounds like there's going to be a new thing for me to hate, which is the rearview mirror that turns into a display for the rearview camera when you put it in reverse. So for 20 years, I've been backing up with my mirrors, and now they're making one of the mirrors a TV screen when you back up. That I'm going to hate that. I predict. I may love it. But so far, none of this stuff has been great for, like, I don't like the Honda Lane Watch TV screen in the dash. Like when you go to look at the mirror and it distracts you with this flashing thing in your periphery. So I don't know. What do you guys think of that like one particular feature? Is that going to be widespread, or is
I think it's a kind of like a gee whiz, you know, yeah, whiz bang feature. They could be like, look at this really cool cutting edge thing we're using for safety. But I think in reality, I mean, personally, I would rather have the rear view mirror, which I definitely use, but also have the, you know, the backup camera like in the center console. So you're kind of, you know, yeah, having both working, because I mean, the mirror catches things that just the camera isn't. Or, you know, of course, I bet they have a feature where you could like, you know, kill it or something. But if it's raining or snowing, I mean, you can't see out the back of your car with a camera.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I mean, we'll know more after LA, but I don't want to condemn it so soon. But you know, that it's sort of like Cadillac is getting its act together, and I was worried about Cadillac. I mean, we think they're sort of finding their second, third, fourth, fifth wind here, and going to revamp their most important products successfully.
I think they're being aggressive, and this is just sort of like the early part of next year. You know, we'll have the CT6, and then we'll have, you know, the XT5, and I mean, that's kind of like, you know, their big, you know, gaudy flagship play, and then you've got that, you know, bread and butter crossover, which is a huge segment right now, and, you know, we'll see. I mean, right now their sales are, I think they're about flat, which is probably better than most people would think they're doing. So, I mean, to me, Cadillac, you know, they need to get, you know, a few more products out there. I think they need to be a little more competitive on pricing. And I think their advertising could be a little bit better, too. I mean, it's glitzy, it's cool, it looks good. But I think they need to find a way to connect with, you know, maybe younger customers, different customers, just something to spruce it up.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen so far, it looks very, very nice. So we'll see what the base models look like, and we'll go from there. All right. So the last topic I wanted to touch on too is Volkswagen stumbling around like a drunk uncle in their latest installment of their make good saga. We saw them come out with a little we're sorry package, a goodwill package for current owners. It's a couple of gift cards. Seems like too little and kind of overly cynical as a way to make it right. I don't know. What do you think they should be doing?
Well, what they should be doing is, until they have the fix, they should take a page out of GM's playbook, or really anyone else's playbook, where it says, if you don't want to drive your car, we will give you a loaner right now. First of all, you're keeping the customer happy. I mean, they've got people that feel betrayed, you know, that thought they were buying a green car and find out they're buying an extra dirty car. You know, get them staying in Volkswagen cars, get that goodwill going. And again, from the GM playbook, get them into the dealer, get the showroom traffic going. Like the number one way GM turned their ignition switch recall into a positive was, you know, like I said, offering people loaners, getting the fix on the key itself, and then bringing people in for the ignition switch. That's like three visits where someone's going to walk through the showroom and, you know, pick up a lease deal. And it actually worked out in their favor, yeah. Sales-wise.
Never put a good crisis to waste, I think, is the old adage. And it's one of those things where it's a nice gesture, you know, what they're doing. I think it's like, you know, gift cards and things like that. But, you know, a loaner, you know, when you give somebody a car, like my wife actually had a Saturn Ion that was recalled, took it to the dealership, and they're like, here's your loaner. It's free. We'll let you know when the car's fixed. And we're like, hey, this is great. We're satisfied customers. I think Volkswagen, it would be a magic bullet, but that would go a long way towards, you know, a real world solution. And then they need to get the real solution. That's one of those things where they need to find that fix. They need to find it soon. And then they need to communicate to people, hey, you know, even more than they already have, they need to cop to it and say, yes, we were wrong. This is what we did. And then here is the way forward, and then move on.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, too. It's a little bit of too little, too late. I mean, the customers and the dealers have been sitting, waiting for answers for, you know, months now. And the answer so far is, here's a gift card that we could have given you in week one. And that's...
Well, so
I'm disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, their tagline for this is like working to make things right, which to me, like, it doesn't seem like they're working to make things right. It seems like they're working to make it go away. I think it's another one of those things that feels very calculated. Like, you know what? Not everybody's going to take us up on this offer, so it's actually going to cost us less. But we get to say, you know, we made those owners whole, while really it seems like a sort of a calculated way to keep the cost of reparations as low as possible, right? Like, we're going to give you $500 you can spend at our dealership, and we'll give you another $500 gift card. But we're going to say we're giving you $1,000. Like, honestly, there's going to be buyers who don't want to continue with the Volkswagen brand. I mean, there'll be some that don't care.
Meanwhile, your resale has probably dropped more than $1,000.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
If Volkswagen has piles of money, or they do for now anyway, I think this is a good chance to... or a good opportunity to use, you know, some of that built up, you know, money they've been making for the last few years, and, you know, spend it to save their reputation.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that they're stumbling on this so badly. Like, the act itself, like the emissions cheats, was bad enough, but then the sort of tone deaf execution of their make goods seems just to make it worse. So. I mean, we're going to see how it goes with it. But I honestly, as a consumer, it confuses me. Like, wait, you're going to give me money to do what? Like, and am I signing away by accepting this? Am I like, do I remove myself from the ability to join a class action lawsuit or that kind of thing where you could actually get more compensation eventually? So
I read that that report. There was one Automotive News kind of dug into that, and I think that's, I don't think it's quite like that where, you know, you're signing away, you can never sue, but there is like a string attached to it. And to me, you can't do a make good or a gesture of goodwill that'd be like, but you have to do this. It's like, right. No, the customer was, you know, totally screwed here. You need to help them, and you can't like lay down any conditions. It's got to be like an unconditional, you know, gesture of goodwill.
Yeah. Does it feel weird for you guys to like see like with this going on, there's still like all of the, like we're driving and reviewing Volkswagen vehicles and trying to like not put a mention of it in everything we write about. But like when you see a new article come up, like, oh, we drove the, you know, the new Passat or something, like, does that just feel weird now to see because there's this in the background?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a, for me, it's odd because you think about other scandals or other screw ups, you know, like Toyota, GM Ignition, I mean, maybe even in Firestone Tire, where they all had You know, you could argue they had gross negligence involved. Maybe the worst would be the Ford Explorer Firestone tire thing, but it wasn't. You know, at the worst, it was like a negligent cover up. Like Volkswagen was actively cheating, and it's such a different thing because it really does undermine. It undermines the whole company, especially given how many people knew or how many people, it looks like how many people might have known, right? Where, you know, like, again, the GM ignition switch was like, yeah, they should have known. They should have had things in place to stop this from happening. But for me, it didn't go, well, all of their cars are now under question. You know, like, is the wheel going to fall off? With this Volkswagen thing, you go, well, they're cheating regulations. What does that, you know, what does that mean about every other bit of compliance they have to do?
Right.
So, this almost reminds me of like the steroid scandal in baseball, you know, where it's like, it was, you know, they made a conscious decision to say, hey, we're going to roid up and try and, you know, do X, Y, Z. You know, there wasn't like, oh, we didn't mean to do this or it was just an oversight. It was like, yes, we're doing this.
Yeah. So we're going to see asterisks next to all their fuel economy numbers for a while or something.
Right.
Like, well, and that was an item this week with the Chevy Colorado GMC Canyon fuel economy figures. Was it 31?
31, I think, highway.
They, like, you know, GM went to pains to say the EPA has verified these emissions.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, other companies
now all diesel comes with an asterisk,
right? And other companies are gonna make hay out of it as much as they can too. They're gonna be like, you know, we're honest about this. We have been working hard, and we're not cheating. So, you know, it's gonna take years to really get to the bottom of this stuff. But so far, I'm less than impressed with Volkswagen's response to their consumers, and I'm sure their dealers are just sort of standing around going, "What the hell, guys?" So.
They kind of need to change the conversation. They need to find a solution and then change the conversation. Because right now, it's been what? Since September, 8 weeks, 7 to 8 weeks. We're still talking about it. We know a little bit more, but we don't have the solution. And we don't really have a lot of answers about what exactly happened. So, I mean, to me, it's dragging on forever.
And where is that German precision?
Where's that convertible Tiguan to distract us from all of this scandal?
Oh, I mean, that's right. Like, we may be able to get some good cars
just
out of it.
Never ends.
Yeah. Or the bully, right? Wasn't it Torchinsky over at Jalopnik who said, you know, just build the bully and distract us all? So I agree with that. That's fun.
Yeah. The bully was great.
So, all right. Well, we have, let's wrap it up. And I've got one question via email. Michael Posner, ESQ. Wrote in and says he's like a 6'1" lawyer, and he said we could mock him, but I don't really want to mess with a lawyer from Florida. But he's he's looking for us to spend his money. He wants us to help him decide between a new Corvette, convertible, or maybe the sort of Targa, an M4 or a Mustang GT or an Audi RS5. So. And there's a couple of used choices too, a 650i and a Porsche 911 or an F-Type V8. So that's a whole lot of different choices, but he's looking for something to drive his 44 miles to work and back, mostly alone, and a convertible.
I don't think you could go wrong with the F-Type. I just like that car because it's fun. I know it's heavy. I know other cars are better than it on the track, but I mean, if you're going to listen to, you can listen to two things in that car, the radio or the exhaust. And I don't think you go wrong either way.
Yeah. F-Type's a strong pick. I would wonder about the headroom for 6'1". I mean, 6'1's tall, but not super tall. So he's probably okay.
You open the convertible. You're cool.
Right. You're all set. You got infinite
headroom. And again, to stay true to myself, I have to be like, you know, convertible. Although, to be honest, I prefer the Corvette Coupe to the convertible in that specific car. But you take the top off and it's.
Yeah, you're
somewhat
fine.
Convertibly. RS5 is a weird pick. It's a weird outside pick that's maybe worth considering just because it sounds so awesome. Mm-hmm. Like that engine is great. It totally, to me, it doesn't justify the like $20,000 premium over an S5, but it is special and it's one of those ones 10 years from now we're going to look at it and go like, "Oh man, this was the cool one that they only made a few of and nobody bought cuz it costs $20,000 more than a car with 90% of the capability."
That's a tasteful play, too. Like, you know, if you want to, you know, you're parking your Audi at the courthouse or whatever, people look at it and say, yep, German car, sophisticated, looks pretty good. Maybe something's up with that, maybe not. You know, enthusiasts will know, but, you know, most people be like, hey, nice car.
That's true. Audi tends, even the RSs, they tend to be a little understated. So
One thing, I kind of like this question. I like this question a lot because it's mostly an image and fashion play, right? Like, what do you want to project? So, you know, like 911, that's a great car. It's a great move. But are you a 911 guy? You know, like, like F-Type, again, like, good choice. I love it. But, I mean, personally, I might be a little too shy for that. I don't know. I'm, it depends on the day, I guess. So it really comes down to, like, what where he is in Florida, what kind of image he projects, you know, how many buttons he keeps down on his shirt. You know, like, you know, LA, like the 911 is like the LA, the Los Angeles Civic, right? So right.
He sent us
California, I would say get something more individual than that, right, which would go back to F-Type.
Well, he sent us a picture of an E30 with a poodle in the passenger seat, E30 convertible. So, I mean, there is a danger, right? Like that to me, like, takes the Corvette off the list because you just don't want to be that guy. even though it's a great car, but it has that image thing. And like you said, you know, the image, unless you just want to completely own it and be like, yeah, screw you, get out of my way. It's my Corvette and I love it. And that's completely acceptable. So it depends. I love the F-Type. And I think it's a beautiful car. It's completely rowdy. It's definitely an extrovert. But it's, you know, it's one of the best Jaguars ever and you can still buy it. So that's cool. Cause before, you know, back when all we had was like the XJ and the XJS, we talked about how they no longer make great Jaguars, and now we've got lots of them. So
wait, the XJS was great?
The XJS was not great.
okay. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love it. It's
I'd rock like a
Fletch, and is the cheapest way to cross a V12 off your bucket list.
Yeah,
but
yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Is like, growing up, everybody talked about how the E-Type was awesome, and like the E-Type had been out of production for a decade at that point. So it was like, yeah, Jaguars used to be great, and now they're these things that are so not reliable.
We have consensus then that he should look pretty hard at the F-Type.
Seriously, at the F-Type. I mean, the 911 is always like that's like an evergreen choice, right? It's, you know, it's going to be a pretty high quality car. You know what the experience is going to be like, but you know, if you're looking for variety and you have the money to blow, go with something different. I think the F-Type's different. The RS5's not a bad choice if you want something understated. You should Google Audi service position.
I was going to make the same joke about Jaguar, which might be unfair. I don't know anything about F-Type service or reliability, but yeah, that definitely Audi. I've heard some nightmare stories of performance Audis too.
Yeah, well, the RS5 too. Like, I'm not sure if that's one of the ones that has the, like, service position takes like 20 minutes to get to, and then it opens up like the whole front of the engine bay, which is great for like timing belts and water pumps and stuff. But the RSs, some of them had the V8, and the timing chains were still tucked up against the firewall, which again makes it very expensive to service. So I mean, look, you're a self-professed car snob lawyer in Florida. You probably have the cash to get it serviced. So if you know, rock on. He has a Corvette too. So
nice.
Yes, yeah, I like the guy. He's got a Corvette.
Yeah, totally.
All right, that'll do it. It's podcast 454, the Mark IV Big Block podcast. Nice. Mike Austin, Greg McLaury, thanks for joining me. We'll be back next week with. I'm assuming we're going to talk about LA next week. So that's
just a little bit, probably.
Yeah. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. See you, Dan.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes. Send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.